136.
Prepare to set fire to the index card of allowable opinion. Your daily dose of liberty education starts here. The Tom Woods Show.
Hey, everybody. Tom Woods here. Very pleased to welcome back to the show James Bovard. James Bovard is an investigative journalist, a great libertarian, the author of 10 books, and in particular, we want to talk today about his wonderful book, Public Policy Hooligan, Rollicking and Wrangling from Helltown to Washington. Here is not only the story of how James Bovard became James Bovard, but also all the stories of his fights against all these government bureaucracies. They can't stand him. He's been singled out by name, by agency after agency, which proves he's doing his job as an investigative journalist. What a rare thing. And so I'm really, really pleased to be able to talk to him about that today. Before I get to James Bovard, I want to thank you guys once again for helping the show by making your Amazon purchases through the Amazon widget that you'll find at tomwoods.com and on all the show notes pages, like today is tomwoods.com/436, where, by the way, you can find Public Policy Hooligan linked there. But entering Amazon through one of those links or through the Amazon widget there at no cost to yourself, you are helping me keep the lights on here, basically. I mean, you all know I have 5 kids. I can't be out of pocket with the show. And you're making it possible for me to have an office to do this in, to have a producer who assists me doing indispensable work. This all makes the show possible. So I give the show, and we all enjoy doing it. I produce one every weekday, and you guys have helped keep it going so that my expenses are covered and I'm able to keep on doing it. And I'm deeply grateful to you for that and for remembering me when you're about to make those Amazon purchases. Okay, now let's turn to James Bovard. Jim, welcome back to the show.
Hey, thanks, Tom. Thanks for having me back on.
We had you on pretty recently, but I wanted to have you back because of your book, Public Policy Hooligan, that looks back on your career, but not just on your career as a journalist, a muckraking journalist in the best tradition, raking the muck where it really is to be found in the corridors of government. But it also tells your personal story. And so often in our formative years, this is when we become the people we are in terms of our ideological outlook. And when I read your story, I didn't know anything about it. I didn't know anything about your family, your background, any work that you did. I didn't know any of this stuff, and I found it very interesting to read about. So before we get into some of the issues that you tackled over the years as a journalist, let's think back to as you were growing up. Tell me a couple of things that happened to you that gave you a jaundiced view of our wise public servants.
Well, there were lots of experiences early on. Hey, thanks very much for having me on, giving me a chance to talk about the book. I really appreciate that, Tom.
My pleasure.
One of the first experiences was I worked for the Virginia Highway Department one summer when I was 16, 17, and, spent out there working with the government employees. That was where I learned how not to shovel.
Okay.
And, it was fascinating just to see the attitude towards labor, because these were folks who were just kind of like, you know, there was a way to lean on a shovel where you don't look like you're completely lazy, where you look like you're getting ready to work. And the most important lesson which I was taught was two things. One, to never be caught with both my hands in my pocket. And two, to never be caught sitting down by the county supervisor. But aside from that, you know, I didn't sweat very much on that job. But there was a mindset there. There were some really nice guys who I was working with, you know, fun to shoot the bull with. I mean, they were not all obscene in their humor. Not to say that I was a choir boy on that, but, there was an attitude towards work where they were basically just killing time. Okay, well, you know, 5 o'clock coming around, let's just kind of shuffle along here. And yeah, I guess it's time to go back to the headquarters and check out. So whereas I was working a private job at that point, I was working at a book bindery where I'd go in once a week and unload trucks. And that paid a lot better. It was a flat fee, basically tax-free. But there, the whole focus was to get the job done as fast as possible and get out of there. And it just encouraged a whole different attitude towards life. And I could see that the government employee mindset, aside from being not very productive, would just kind of could tend to drag a person down through life.
I want to get on the recording here, the episode near the 7-Eleven.
All right.
I won't say anything about it. I want you to tell that story.
Okay. Let me pull this up here. Okay.
Because that would have formed me. I would have looked at the police very, very differently for the rest of my life after an episode like that.
Well, okay. How should I start this out? I mean,
well, they were accusing you of all kinds of crazy things that you had no intention of doing.
That's true. That's true. So a second episode that had a formative influence. I was wheeling and dealing in rare coins from the time I was in junior high. And it was a bull market time for rare coins, so it was a little bit difficult to lose money that way. But I was buying and selling from different dealers across the country, and I would sometimes go to coin shows. And around Thanksgiving 1973, I borrowed my family car and drove up 300 miles to the Washington, D.C. area for a big coin show. And I got there early, and I was kind of, it would have been expensive to get a motel room. So the thing I figured I'd do, like I'd done sometimes before, I'd just kind of sleep in the back of the Ford Pinto that I was driving, just, flop it down, take it easy there. Since I had like $1,000 worth of rare coins with me at that point, I had a track starter pistol with me that I just kind of left on the front seat. And later on, when I was crashing out, I had it on the floor of the vehicle, and I just didn't think, just in case someone wants to bother me, the person might see that and go away. Well, apparently someone, I was trying to find a good place to crash out, so I ended up parking next to a 7-Eleven because it was well lit and heavily trafficked. Not the smartest thing I ever did, but what the heck. A little while later, I noticed a police car pulling into the parking lot with flashing lights. So I figured, maybe someone was jaywalking nearby, and on the nearby Jefferson Davis Highway. A couple minutes later, a second police car pulled in. There were four policemen were huddled outside the first car. Perhaps these guys had seen two jaywalkers. So this tall, brown-haired young cop comes over, knocks in my front window. He says, "Can I see some ID?" I said, "Yeah, sure." So I handed it to him, and so the cop starts going over the interior of my car with his powerful flashlight. He fixates for several seconds on that starter pistol that was laying on the floor next to a couple paper bags. And so the cop asked if I have a firearm. I said, "No, I've got a track starter pistol. That's what you just shined your light on." And he says, "Step out of the car." I said, "Well, okay." So I stepped out, and he says, "Sir, you're under arrest for concealing a deadly weapon." I said, "Bullshit. It's not a weapon. It wasn't concealed. It's something that you saw before you even ask about it." He says, "It was concealed. That's a crime." I said, "You saw it." He says, "You have the right to remain silent," so on and so forth. So he pulls out the handcuffs, and, it might have been BS, but I was outnumbered 4-1, and those guys had real guns. So I was frisked and shoved in the back of the car. The tow truck comes up and beelines from my car. I told the police to make sure that my stash of coins got out of there before it was towed away. So I was cuffed and stuffed and driven to the police station. And somewhere along the way, there was a bureaucratic miracle. It was like the Bible story, water turning into wine. Instead of a starter pistol just laying on the floor, at some point that starter pistol got hid inside of two bags. And that was the kind of transubstantiation which changed a few paltry facts into sinister criminal behavior. Instead of a dim-witted country kid bumbling within city limits, which I was, the cops could pretend that they had grabbed a hitman waiting to wreak late-night havoc at 7-Eleven.
Yeah, because a lot of hitmen you want to hire fall asleep with the gun visible,
And I was 17 at the point, so it's like, what is this stuff? And so, as the story went along, the cops actually accused me of robbing that 7-Eleven. And I was thinking, so I was sitting, I was outside, trying to sleep. Was I using ESP to try to steal the cash register or what? Now, it was interesting. I not had much experience at that point in life with dealing with adults who were just completely brazen liars. But that's what the cop who arrested me was. That's what the police and superintendent who spent the next 3 hours basically browbeating me, trying to get me to confess. Hour after hour, I guess probably to about 3 o'clock in the morning. And they were just kind of, and those guys needed a confession because they didn't have squat. They had, okay, so there was a starter pistol. And, you know, I was in the car. And so what? But apparently there had been another 7-Eleven robbed somewhere nearby that night. And I said to these guys, okay, was the other robber, you know, almost 6 feet tall and burly and red-haired? Well, we don't know. I mean, if you don't know that, if you can't get a basic ID. But it was interesting for the to go through the browbeating, to be accused of crime after crime. First of all, they were the cops accused me of robbing another 7-Eleven store early that evening. I was accused of stealing the starter pistol. I was accused of stealing the blank caps for the gun. The cops must have thought I was cheap. The cops accused me of running away from home and stealing the family car. Was the vehicle reported as stolen? I don't think so. They accused me of stealing the coins I had with me. I had various receipts I showed that maybe they thought they were elaborate forgeries, or maybe the cops didn't read so good. And the final offense was compounded. All the other crimes was I was guilty of perjury. And I said, well, how am I guilty of perjury? Well, you're guilty of perjury because you won't confess to all these other things. And I'm thinking like, I was dumb to have that on the floor of the car, but I wasn't stupid enough to confess. And thanks to that, those cops eventually had to, they had to recognize that they had no right to hold me, though I was stuck in a juvenile center for about for the rest of the night and part of the next day until my parents would come and sign me out. And I think if I'd known the right phrases, the right legal phrases, I could have gotten out sooner, but I didn't. But it was a very educational experience, you know. But I learned from that, and that was the last time that I ever slept next to a 7-Eleven.
Yeah, I was going to say that would be one of the lessons that you would certainly take away from this. I want to talk about some of your journalistic work over the years, particularly because there was an item in the news the other day about the actor Hugh Jackman, who apparently is trying to do philanthropic work. And I don't want to make fun of people who are doing what they think to be right in what they think to be a good cause. So he was somewhere in Africa, and he's trying to help people there. And I thought, well, if he really wants to help people, I'm sure he's favoring spreading the market economy all over the world. So I read the article, you know, more or less knowing what to expect. But I have to admit, he did, you know, there were things like the purpose of our program is not to get people dependent on it, but to get things started and then leave them on their own two feet. So I thought, all right, well, that's a pretty good start. And then he talked about the miracles that could take place if we would just pay a little bit more for coffee, if we would pay fair trade rates for coffee, then we'd have all these issues. So in other words, as long as we're extremely patronizing toward these people, and we make our purchases on the basis of something other than we make all of our other purchases, then things will be fine. So there's something screwy about that. And I know you wrote a book called Fair Trade Fraud, and you talk about it in this book, Public Policy Hooligan. What's your initial response to a claim like that?
These are folks who think that their own good intentions are morally superior to the law of supply and demand, voluntary marketplace interactions. There was a study which I saw that talked about fair trade coffee, and it turned out that apparently that the fair trade, that the coffee which is labeled fair trade, is actually lower quality than a lot of the coffee produced in the same areas, which is not sold under a fair trade label, because the farmers apparently know that, well, you know, the folks who are buying on fair trade basis will take anything. Whereas if they're going for some private sale, it needs to be good quality. So the folks who are act like they're doing this notion of fair trade, they're getting shafted on price and quality. But I'm fascinated by this whole notion of fair trade, and it was something which I started writing about in the mid 1980s, and I was curious that folks would have faith that politicians setting prices would be fairer than the voluntary agreements of buyers and sellers, and it doesn't matter what side of a national border that they're on. But the whole idea of these trade barriers, and it was throughout American history, it had a significant influence in causing the American Civil War. But these folks who want to put politicians on a pedestal and act like they have the wisdom and the decency to dictate prices, because that is what trade barriers do. Trade barriers allow politicians to take consumers hostage.
But isn't it the case that if only this particular person Hugh Jackman is pointing to could get a fair shake, if only he could get a start, then his life would be vastly improved? But all we do is look for cheap prices. Isn't that short-sighted and selfish on our part? Shouldn't we want to help these brand-new producers in these less developed countries?
Well, if you look at the history of the Third World, the farmers throughout the Third World in many areas have thrived wonderfully in places where the government is not shafting them. In so many places, much of the worst suffering in the last 60 years has been in Africa, and that's also the place where the governments have been most idiotic and predatory. World Bank and sometimes U.S. Foreign aid agencies would bankroll these farm boards, which had a monopoly over the farmers and would set prices at an artificially unfair low rates that would bankrupt farmers and help lead to famine. And the governments bankrolled by us and World Bank have had so many other stupid policies. One of my favorite ones was there was a country in Africa in the mid-80s which had a tariff of, I think, 63% on used tractors. Now, this is a country that had a lot of good farmland, arable farmland that was not being plowed. It was only being plowed once a year instead of twice or three times, but they were keeping out the tractors. And so you're dealing with a group of politicians who are almost stupid or predatory beyond belief, and U.S. policy has propped them up. And what's happened with some of these voluntary, these non-government entities that go abroad, many of them have also propped up governments who are the worst enemies of the farmers and of everybody else in that country.
I would think, by the way, also that if I'm suddenly buying coffee from some fair trade producer, that I'm overlooking the really numberless people who just haven't gone through the bureaucratic hoops to get the official fair trade designation, who are just as worthy of my consumer dollar, who are just as destitute, just as much in need of it, but just through the arbitrariness of politics don't have the official gold star seal of approval.
Absolutely. And I'm very distrustful of any situation which gives some people the arbitrary power to dictate that some price or some group or some entity is fair. Because fairness should be based on the voluntary agreement of the buyer and the seller. And as soon as you have something else aside from that, you're going to have a lot of corruption, and there's going to be exploitation and abuse. And that's the history of trying to patronize third world farmers. I mean, the thing which we should have done, and we've done a little bit of it, simply open our markets to third world agriculture products. That's far more help to third world farmers than any handout from the U.S. government or from private voluntary groups.
Let's talk about the Department of Labor and some of your work over there. It was, I guess, back in the, if I'm remembering this right, back in the 1980s that we had, early 1980s, that we had the CETA program. It must have been, I don't remember what it stood for, but it had something to do with employment training. And it was a job training program, something like that.
Yeah, well, it was a